stuff. Hi, I'm Martha. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
Can I feel like I can't see. I need to be able to see Lynn. Oh, okay. My sobriety date is September 9th, 2015. I have a sponsor. I sponsor other women in the program. I talked to my sponsor yesterday. I used to judge people that said that. I'm like, you're supposed to call your sponsor every day. So now I'm being honest with you and admitting that I did not call my sponsor today. I have a home group. It's the Our Way Out group. We meet at St. Mark's Church on Lux Lane, down off Courthouse Road in Richmond, Virginia, on Saturday mornings at 9:30. And we have childcare. If you ever are in Richmond and you need a meeting, and you, with or without children, come see us. It's a big book study. You know, it's funny. I was, you know, telling people, you know, I remember the first time I was told my story at a meeting, I was telling my mom that I was going to do it. And then when we dropped our kids off tonight to come this way, you know, the friends that were watching the kids, everybody's like, well, good luck, break a leg, do great. It's going to be fine. You're going to do a good job. You know, I remember my mom asking me, like, what are you going to talk about and all that stuff? And I'm like, I don't know, Mom. Like, I never know. I don't think about it. I just, whatever comes out of my mouth is going to be okay. But I know that I'm supposed to, in a general way, describe what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And so I'll do the best I can to do that tonight. You know, I grew up in Gloucester. I was talking to Billy about that. Gloucester, Virginia, not Gloucester, Massachusetts. It is spelled the same way. It's a really small town. If you were driving from Tappahannock to Yorktown, you have to drive through Gloucester. That's basically the only reason you might go through there. A lot of retirees live there now, and I thought it was terrible to live in Gloucester growing up. There was nothing to do. My dad was a local attorney. My mom was a stay-at-home mom, and you know, we had a really good life. I was a middle child, the only girl, older brother, younger brother. And I was adopted, and they were biological. So I used that as an excuse for a long time to explain why I was different from my brothers and why I was different from my family, nurture versus nature and all of that. But I had a really normal childhood. You know, I really did. I come from a family that my parents were together until the day my father died. And, you know, just very loving. You know, my mom was Catholic. My dad was Presbyterian. So they, which is really hard when your faith is important to you and you marry into a different religion, especially, you know, 45 years ago, it was really hard for them. And so what they decided to do to make it even was that the girls would go to the Catholic church, the boys would go to the Presbyterian church. So I got to grow up Catholic. Very much through middle school and high school, would start attending the Presbyterian church regularly, and as soon as I turned 18, became Presbyterian. But I was raised in the Catholic church, and that was really how I was introduced to God, was at church and in our home. You know, my mom would do the rosary, and we would always pray before dinner, and we would always say our prayers at night, and that was about it. I don't know how old I was when I realized how early my mom got up every single morning to do her prayer time with God. And when I now know she does every single day at like 5:30 in the morning. I always thought it was weird, but I get it now. So, you know, I never actually had a relationship with a higher power. It took this program. It took reaching a bottom emotionally and mentally and physically, and being in enough pain to actually try and build a relationship with a higher power. I'd always believed in God, though. And I never believed in a fearing God. I believed in a foxhole prayer God. I believed in a God that when I needed help, I could pray and God would grant my wish. You know, like praying to win the basketball game when I was 9. I remember sitting there with all my might just praying, God, please help us win. Please help us win. And that was how I prayed for a very, very long time. I took my first drink. You know, it's to be determined. When I took my first drink, I know my mom, again, you know, being Catholic, wine was pretty important. You know, I had my first communion when I was 7. You know, that didn't really count. excuse me. And she would have parties, and I remember being, I don't know, 12 or 13 and sneaking off and drinking some of the wine out of the jugs, like the Livingston jugs of wine. And dancing around in the yard, acting like what I thought you were supposed to act like when you were drunk. But I do remember the first time that I got drunk. I do remember that. You know, there were a couple times where I drank but didn't get drunk. But the first time I got drunk and I drank alcoholically that night. I had driven up to Kentucky with my best friend from school for some family wedding. And she had an older cousin who had, you know, the basement was decked out with the pool table and the Bud Light and the darts. And I remember running around that night drinking the bottom of everybody's Bud Light, like running and finding them all and drinking until it was all gone. And I remember my first hangover. I remember the next morning falling asleep in the back seat, you know, leaning up against my friend, you know, how her parents didn't know we were hungry. I'm sure they did. But that was the first time I drank, and I just really, really loved it. And whatever it was, whatever that feeling was, I just didn't want to let it go. It changed me. And so, you know, getting into, that was middle school probably. Getting into high school, I was, I remember being told by this kid in Sunday school that I was a goody-goody. And I was 13, and I didn't want to be a goody-goody. You know, I'd been given all kinds of gifts in life, and I wanted to throw them away real early. I didn't want to be normal. I didn't want to be the good girl, you know. Something inside of me wanted to be different or thought I was different or didn't deserve the good. Then I definitely didn't know what it was. Now I know that I was, you know, alcoholic and had a God-sized hole inside of me from a very young age and tried to fill it with anything that would make me feel better or normal. After that guy called me a goody-goody, that's when I like went off, and that weekend I tried to do anything that I could. I smoked my first cigarette, got high for the first time, found the alcohol. And from that moment on, I was the rebellious girl. I was the girl that was going to break the rules. I was the girl that was going to sneak out of the house, steal her parents' car, go to the parties she wasn't supposed to go to, hang out with the people that she wasn't supposed to. If my mom didn't like you, then I was going to be daggone sure that you were my new best friend. And, you know, just so rebellious. God, I was grounded most of high school. I was absolutely grounded most of high school, which to me, like, if my parents just had let me do what I wanted to do, I wouldn't have had to sneak out as much. But I remember, you know, my friends would come over and we would go down, and we had a 3-story home that my parents had built in Gloucester on 5 acres of land. And we'd go down in the closet in the basement with my mom's blender and make mixed drinks with my dad's Clan MacGregor Scotch whiskey. Like, you can't put anything in there to make that taste good. And I remember, you know, it was my 2 best friends, and, you know, God, I'm so blessed. They're still my 2 best friends, and they're not alcoholic. But they were with me, and we were drinking, and, you know, I got the idea, okay, it's time to sneak out, right, because we've got a couple drinks in us, and what else are we going to do? So I called my friend to come pick us up so we could go smoke weed with her old boyfriend and all that stuff. And I remember leaving the house, and we're running, trying to make sure that we get to the end of the driveway in time, because it takes a while. We live down in the country. And I look over at my friend, and she's running, and she's just projectile vomiting. And, you know, and it was just – and she's like, I'm okay. It's fine. And I was like, what's wrong with her? You know, and so from that moment on, I realized that those people couldn't handle their liquor, but I could, and that stuck with me for a long time. That actually made me think that I wasn't alcoholic for a long time, because I wasn't the fall down, you know, puking, blacking out. I actually did black out more than I thought. I've learned now, but, you know, I thought that that cough didn't make me an alcoholic, because I could handle my liquor. When we got home, the other one was holding the other one's hair back in the toilet, and it was a mess. And I remember thinking then that, man, they just really couldn't handle their alcohol. You know, when I was 16, my mom came into my room on a Sunday morning and woke me up and said that it was time to go to church and let me know that my sister had died the night before. And, you know, yeah, that doesn't make sense, because I said middle child, only girl, but my parents were never supposed to have children. And when, before they had my older brother, they fostered a lot of children. And so I had a sister who they brought in when she was 16. They put her through college and nursing school and raised her as their own. And she had 2 daughters who were my age. And so my sister was much older than me. And I used to, actually the first time I stole my parents' car was under the direction of my sister. She was an alcoholic. She was one of us. And she died from this disease. She didn't know about or hear about or was able to hear about a solution. But yeah, she told me to steal my parents' car and come over and party. And so I would party with her daughters while she would stay in the back room and just get drunk and, you know, on pills and all that stuff. So I remember my mom saying, "Your sister died. Come on, get up. We're going to church." And I was so mad that she was going to make me go to church. And I cried the whole time we were at church. I didn't understand what was going on. And I found out later that she had had a pulmonary embolism at 38. And so, you know, that was hard. That was my first time losing somebody to this disease. And I couldn't, I mean, as a 16-year-old who was just running around fully focused on self and having a good time and not really caring about anything else, I couldn't understand that. I didn't understand what that meant. I know that I started partying with her daughters even more. We got into a lot of drugs and alcohol and trouble together. The sneaking out didn't stop. That's why I was so happy to go to college, because I didn't have to sneak out anymore, right? I could do what I want. I almost didn't get into college. I know that's a shocker, but I was an average student. You know, I was the kind of girl that I could cram the night before for a test and go in and get like a B minus or a C. I learned later in life that if I actually like paid attention in class and did my homework, I was an A student and had the opportunity to graduate cum laude from college, many, many years down the road. Even when I was still drinking, I did get it together enough to do that. But the first time I went off to college, I thought I was going to have to join the Navy because my grades were so bad. And it was, embedded in our heads that we go to college. Like, that's what our family does. My mother has 3 master's degrees. My father has, he was an attorney. You know, since then, my brother's gone on. He's an attorney. My little brother has a master's in divinity. And it's amazing that I graduated college, you know. And it took me a really long time to do so. But I ended up, I had a lot of talents growing up that I threw away for alcohol and for drugs and for boys and for anything that would make me feel better than being me. And I actually ended up getting a scholarship for voice. I loved music, and I sang, and I sang in the church choir, and I got a scholarship to a little women's college down in North Carolina, and everyone was shocked and very excited, and so off I went. And actually, that best friend that was running and throwing up, she got a voice scholarship too and went down with me. After the first semester, she left because she left because she was miserable. She left because she didn't connect. She didn't make friends. Music wasn't fun anymore. I carried around for a long time until I made amends to her that she left because I wasn't a good friend to her. I don't have that kind of power. I got the opportunity to learn that too through an amends, that I'm not that powerful. But I did think that that's what it was, that she left Salem because I ditched her, because I did, because I immediately went and found the girls that I knew my mom wouldn't want me to be friends with. And, you know, the drugs kicked up, the alcohol kicked up, I switched roommates like 2 weeks in to be with the fun girl who lived 45 minutes away, whose dad had a bar in his basement, and he was from Germany, so he didn't care that we drank underage. So we would get in her little Volvo and drive to her house and drink in the basement and drugs, and it was a grand old time. I actually remember when I went to, before I even got to college, I went for an overnight. You know, they do an overnight in college, and I found somebody like me, and instead of doing the activities for overnight and like staying with the person you're supposed to be with and learning about the school, she had a car, so we left and went and partied, and I came back at like 4 a.m, a poor girl that I was staying with. I'm like banging on her dorm door, like, "I'm back." You know, I wasn't even college yet, so. After the first semester, I dropped music because it wasn't fun anymore, right? Because it made it work. And I left Salem that first year of college. I left, I think, with a 1.2 GPA. My parents were like, "You're out of there. Yeah, you got a partial scholarship, not a full ride. We're still paying a lot of money for you to do school. You're coming home. You're moving in with us. You're going to college, and you're paying for it yourself." So I got to enroll in the local community college, Rappahannock Community College. And so I did. And after, it was halfway through the first semester there, I met him, you know, the one, and we dropped out of school. because all you need is love, right? I was 19. Moved out of my parents' house. My parents didn't know what to do with me. So for the first time in my life, with my rebellious behavior of coming home one weekend and just saying, I'm out, you know, I'm going to move in with this guy, they didn't fight me. They didn't argue. They didn't push back. They didn't try and, you know, beg me to stay. They said, well, here's your mother's car. You can't get to work and school without a car. And they let me go. And I didn't come back for 12 years. I mean, I saw them, but I didn't come back emotionally. I was gone. I didn't need them. And so within 6 months, I'm engaged to this guy, and we have a long engagement because we are young. So I got married at 21, and my parents, you know, paid for the wedding and were supportive. And, you know, the only thing they said is right as I was about to turn the corner in my wedding dress, my dad turned to me and said, you sure you want to do this? And I was like, Dad. But I think dads have to say that, isn't that? I don't know. And that relationship was, you know, I mean, man, we were young and dumb, and the drugs and the alcohol was just absolutely the forefront of a relationship. And, you know, you take two young kids who don't really understand what love is, and you mix in a little booze. You know, it was tumultuous. It was a really rough relationship. We didn't know what we were doing. We were definitely partying a lot. Drugs were a huge part of my story at that time. They just really were. This is when my alcohol really... I really started loving the effects of alcohol. And so this is when I started, and I didn't like the taste yet though. And so I would beer bong beers, like instead of drinking them, I had a beer bong and I would pour a beer into a beer bong and every 20 minutes or so do another beer bong. And that's how I drank. It's a little potential alcoholic-y. I don't know what you guys think, but you know, usually it's like, we'll do one beer bong a night maybe, but you know, I was doing 10. So that relationship fell apart. You know, there was infidelity, shocker. And you know, we split off for a bit, and you know, that my husband, his mom and her girlfriend used to go to these meetings like every Wednesday and Friday. Like, we couldn't play spades with them because they would be going to these meetings, and I learned that they were AA, and I didn't understand why they had to go every single week. But when we split up, my husband started going to NA. And when we started talking about getting back together, he asked me to go with him. So I went to an NA meeting with him, and I was so uncomfortable. And it was Gloucester, and there was like six people there. And they asked me to read something, and I was like, I'm just here to support. Yeah, okay, I'll read it. And I didn't understand what I was reading. And I don't remember anything about the meeting, really. I didn't hear anything about steps or recovery or really what it meant. I was there to support him. And what happened is we ended up getting back together and we stayed sober for a couple of months. You know, we at this point just decided, you know, drugs and alcohol were playing a big part in our lives and maybe we should just pump the brakes a little bit. And we did for a while. And I remember I was really kind of high and mighty about it. You know, we do game nights at my house and I was like, but don't bring alcohol because we're not drinking, you know, and my friends were really cool about it and it was fine. And I don't remember when I started drinking again though, because it was that way for a while and it was fine. And I'd gone back to college. I was at ODU now and I was waiting tables and, you know, he had a good job in Williamsburg. And I have no idea when I started drinking again. I can't remember the first drink, but we were suddenly back into that life and partying and it was a mess again, very, very quickly. One day I came home and he said that he couldn't forgive me for the infidelity and that he was leaving me. And so I said, okay. And I left and went to go live with his stepmom, who's a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. God bless her for taking me in, because I was crazy there was about 6 weeks there when we had separated. I was just bringing people home, random people home into her house. I was drinking. I was using. I was a mess. I was working a job up in Richmond. I was commuting from Gloucester to Richmond, and I thought I was having the time of my life. One day I got back from Richmond and actually came back in a U-Haul. I was ready to move up to Richmond. I was moving forward in my life. I'd been separated from my husband for about 6 weeks. And his whole family was there, and it didn't make any sense, like his grandparents and his brother and his cousin. And when I got out of the U-Haul, I was like, what's everybody doing here? And, you know, I was a little high, and I don't think I was drunk. I think I was just a little high. And they told me that my husband had died, that they had found him in bed, unconscious, and by the time they got him to the hospital, he was pronounced dead. He was 26 years old. At that point, I understood that drugs killed you, but not alcohol. You know, even so, yeah, I had lost a sister, you know, 10 years before, but it was the drugs. So I decided not to do drugs anymore. And it's so funny because the more I get sober, the more I realize that I didn't stop doing drugs. I just didn't do them a lot. But my alcohol really, really kicked it up because I had to have something in me in order to feel okay about who I was. I had to have something inside of me to make me feel normal. And it says even in our big book, you know, like I never open it, but it's here as like a tool. Like, let me flip to my favorite page and read this amazing thing. I never use it. But it says, you know, and now I lost my train of thought. Whatever. It says something very profound, I'm sure. I don't even remember what I was talking about. But anyway, so, our drinking life becomes the only normal one. I knew that's in there. Thanks God. And that's what it was. It just became normal for me. I went up to Baltimore, opened up a business, direct sales company, was having a great time, felt like I was, living large, right? It reminds me of Bill's story. Like, there's a whole section in there where he's, you know, the maelstrom of New York and all of that stuff. And that was Baltimore for me. Like, I was 25 years old. I owned a business. You know, I had employees. I could do whatever I wanted, you know, and, you know, I could leave for lunch and drink all afternoon, and that would be okay. And my ego was getting pretty big. I really thought I was hot shit. I really did. And I owned my business up there for about 3 years, and it was successful, and I was ranked nationally, and it was great. Drink was taking an important part of my life, and the parties were big and fun, and I was, you know, partying with all my coworkers. They weren't coworkers, they were employees, right? And they were living with me, and it was just a mess. And so it was a big surprise to me, but for anybody watching my life, it wouldn't have been a surprise for them. I got pregnant. And I got told that by the father that he didn't want anything to do with that. He happened to be my business partner, so that was a little awkward. And so when I was 8 months pregnant, I decided to sell my shares in my company and move home to Gloucester. And that's when God brought me back to my family. It was really cool to be able to go back and see that. You know, I wish I could say that I didn't drink when I was pregnant. I probably only got drunk a couple times. But, you know, you could have the glass of red wine at night. And so I would have a big glass of red wine. And there was one time where I remember getting a six-pack of beer and drinking all of it. And that feeling when I finished it, there was this ease and comfort that immediately disappeared with this guilt and this sense of impending doom, and that I was already concerned that my child was going to be messed up because of how depressed and sad I was. It was at this point in my life where I purchased, and it still sits on my bookshelf, the Codependence Guide to the 12 Steps. I was starting to buy the self-help books and things like that. I didn't even know what the 12 Steps were. I should have at that point. I'd been to meetings, I'd heard about it, but and so I went home and I had my daughter, and I figured I could find a job anywhere from Richmond to the beach. And I did. When my daughter was 4 months old, I got hired at a sales position in Richmond. And so off I went, and my alcoholism, I mean, that's having that kid. That's where it got bad. I suddenly was responsible for someone other than myself, and I'm super self-centered, And I'm very selfish, and I think about myself only. And so then suddenly there was this tiny human that needed me, that, like, depended on me to survive. And it made me so uncomfortable that I had to drink. And I became a daily drinker. I had to drink to be able to sit on the floor to play with my child and interact with her. I had to drink in order to go home. Like, I would drink. I was commuting for a while, and I would drink all the way from Richmond to West Point, like, in the car on the way, because I had to go pick up my kid from daycare. I had to drink in order to be with her, interact with her. It's a lot of the same for a couple of years there. A lot of just daily drinking. I was in sales, so I would go to the bar 3, 2, 1, 12, you know, and have a couple drinks and bring my laptop and my cell phone and send emails and feel really important, like I was doing a great job for the company that I was working for. I was taking shots of whiskey. And then I would drive and go pick her up from daycare and go home and drink until I packed out, blacked out, passed out, fell asleep. But that would always happen around 10 because I'd usually been drinking for about 8 hours at that point. And I'd always get up for work, right? And I remember towards the end of my drinking that I really loved the hangover. You gotta be really alcoholic to enjoy your hangover. Because it felt normal. It felt normal to me. It felt normal to wake up thirsty and sick and tired and like not rested, and it energized me. And then around 10 or 11, I would feel real sick, and then by 1 or 2, I was having alcohol in my system again, so it was okay. So that went on for quite a while, and then I remember August 9th is my birthday, and I had my daughter was almost 3, and I took her to my parents for the weekend, and I had a big blowout for my birthday, which included just, like, Ubering and meeting people up at the bars and bar hopping and doing coke off the back of the bathroom toilet. You know, the huge. It was then that I didn't realize it till later, but I was like, wow, drugs really came back into my life pretty hardcore at the end. And I was doing a lot of that stuff. I was doing things that would help me drink more. Me who had sworn off drugs because they kill people, right? And I remember going home and picking up my daughter and just being so, so, so hungover and sick and not being able to have a drink because I was visiting with my parents who'd kept her that weekend. And I remember sitting and talking with my dad and just having a really nice conversation. And 2 days later, I got a phone call. I got lots of phone calls. You know, when you look down at your phone and you have missed calls from, like, everybody in your family, you know something bad's happened. And I called my little brother back, and he let me know that my father had passed away suddenly. And that killed me. Everybody in my life had died suddenly. You know, I've lost a sister and a husband and now a father, and it was sudden and, no warning. And I remember I was still very drinking and probably very hungover. But I just remember my mom talking about what we do to protect our children. And I remember not, like, reacting in front of my daughter and taking her to daycare and then, like, losing it on the way. But we buried my father, and my family is just so amazing. We made every single decision together, from the music to whether we were going to cremate him, everything. My brothers, my mom, every decision we made together. But at this point, they were really holding me up. I think I was really going along with whatever they said because I wasn't capable of much. And it was, when people die, that's an excuse to drink, Any excuse there was to drink, I always took it. Like Christmas, the holidays, all that stuff. And that's why no one in my family knew I was an alcoholic because, I always just took advantage of the opportune moments to drink. And I would go balls out in front of them. That was just the only time I would do it in front of them. But I remember the night before my dad's funeral going over to a neighbor's and they're pouring, some kind of bourbon. And I remember thinking that I'm having too much. And the next morning I woke up feeling very, very, very strange. I was ravenous. Like I couldn't get enough to eat. I felt lightheaded. I didn't really feel hungover and I should have been. And, you know, we did the burial service, and then we went in and into the funeral, and there were over 300 people at my father's funeral. And we had bagpiper there, and we had an all-male a cappella choir, and the minister sang a song from the pulpit, and it was a beautiful service that I was unable to even take in. I couldn't even show up for my father for the funeral because I was passing out in the front row. Like, they had to go get me something to drink and get me food because I was literally passing out, like, lightheaded, couldn't stand up. So I had to be taken home, and somebody gave me a Valium or Xanax or something wonderful and tasty like that, and I suddenly felt way better. And I convinced myself, because other people had told me, that I was in shock. Right? Because this used to happen all the time. Like, people would say, you know, something would be wrong with me and I wouldn't know what it was, which is the story of my life when I was drinking. I never knew what was wrong with me. And somebody would suggest something and I'm like, that must be it. Yeah. So I was in shock. So, you know, the Xanax and the later alcohol made it all feel better, and soon it was forgotten about. And so I bumbled through life for the next month, drinking the way I always did, you know, going to the bar, picking up the kid, going home, drinking until I passed out. And I had a bartender. Like, she was my bartender. No, she worked at a bar that other people went to that bar, and she waited on them, but she was my bartender. You know, she would give me $40 worth of liquor and charge me for a tea as long as I gave her a big tip. And so I remember September 8th, about a month after Dad died, going to the bar. I actually went to lunch, a business lunch, and we had 2 9% beers at the Capitol Ale House or wherever we were. And that was enough for me to have the phenomenon of craving, right? That was enough for me. I didn't know that's what it was. But I was really thirsty. I needed to keep drinking. So I canceled my appointments for that afternoon, went to the bar, called an ex-boyfriend, come drink with me. So we drank at the bar for 4 or 5 hours that afternoon, went and picked up my daughter from daycare, drove home, yes, all the time, driving with my child in the car. Went to the pool. You know, I did what I always do. I would take a big swig out of a vitamin zero, like a vitamin water, and then fill the rest with vodka, and take like 2 or 3 of those down to the pool with me. At some point, I drove to Arby's. My bartender came over later with some enhancing drugs to help us drink more. And the next thing I knew, I was waking up the next morning. It was 9:30, and my daughter was in the bed with me. And so she'd just turned 3. It wasn't until I got sober, and this was a huge moment, and it wasn't even a year ago. I've been sober a little over 3 years, that I realized that my daughter never has once slept until 9:30 in the morning, and that my 3-year-old, I'm 100% sure, at some point had tried to wake me up and she couldn't. I didn't even know that then. But I was late for my professional headshot, so I jumped up and got ready and took my daughter to daycare. But I had this sense of doom, like that the walls were all closing in on me and this hangover didn't feel right. And, I started to have, a panic attack, and I had anxiety for the last 3 years of my drinking. And I used to quiet with alcohol. It happened after I had my daughter. And I started dealing with anxiety, and, I thought I was going to crawl out of my skin, and I was sick to my stomach. And I remember looking down on my phone, and I had all these text messages from those best friends that couldn't handle their liquor back in the past and all that, saying, you know, thinking of you today on your dad's birthday. And I hadn't even realized it. I had not even realized that it was my dad's birthday. And that hit me really hard. And the anxiety went way up, and I had to get out of there. I just left work, and I'm driving around, and I feel like I can't breathe. And I look at my phone, and I Googled AA. Which I'd never done that before. It's better now when you Google AA, but then apparently there was an ad that popped up and I clicked on it and called that number, and I was like, hi, I think I need help. And they were like, do you need to go to treatment? And I was like, no, and I hung up, and I was like, I don't know who that was, but that was scary. And I'm driving around, like, no idea, all this anxiety, and I think I'm going to die. And the thought comes to me to call my late husband's stepmom, who I'd lived with, who'd been going to AA meetings and, you know, that A&A and all that. And so I did. And out of my mouth when she answered the phone is I said, I think I need help. I can't stop drinking. That thought had never occurred to me before. I'd had ex-boyfriends call me an alcoholic. And, you know, I was like, people who throw rocks shouldn't live in glass houses. You know, I would always throw it back at him and, like, but drinking was who I was. Like, it was part of who I was, part of my DNA. And when those words came out, I was like, what in the world? And she said, where are you? And at this point, I was parked in front of a hospital ER because I thought I was dying. And I was like, I'm parked in front of a hospital. And she said, stay right there. Don't move. I'm going to have somebody call you. And 2 minutes later, a woman in Richmond in Alcoholics Anonymous called me. And I knew she was from AA. And she sat and she talked to me. And then she put me in touch with another woman, a woman who was a single mother, who I called that afternoon. And she invited me and my daughter over to her house for dinner that night with her and her son. And I haven't had a drink since then. She invited me to my first meeting a couple days later. I didn't know what to do with myself. I did not know what to do with myself. I just had never felt that way before. I was completely hopeless. And I had no idea how important alcohol was in my life. I had no idea how much I needed it. And I surely didn't want to stop because I need it. So I go to my first AA meeting, and there is a guy in his, you know, 50s or late 50s, you know, older guy, gray hair, standing up telling his story, you know, talking about his big gulp full of vodka. And I'm weeping, like I'm uncontrollably like shaking and crying. And I've got the girl who invited me there, and apparently the guy's wife was beside me, and she's laughing. And I do remember hearing that laughter. She's laughing at him and all this stuff. And I'm just like a ball of mess and fear and sadness. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm that. I drink like that. I'm an alcoholic. And they explained what the white chip was to me, and I got up and I picked up a white chip. I eventually asked that other single mom to be my sponsor, and we started working the steps. And, you know, I changed sponsors pretty early because she never, like, answered my call. And I thought a sponsor was somebody that drops everything to save me, to help me when I feel like I need a drink. And what was suggested by that woman, my stepmom, who'd been sober for 35 years, is why don't you read the pamphlet on sponsorship? And so I did that. And I remember a woman was sharing at a meeting, and she had something about her. She was just glowing, and she talked about God in a way that I'd never heard before. And I asked her to be my sponsor, and that's when I actually really started working the steps, probably about 3 months in, 4 months in. I had done some of the steps. I'd done the third step and done the fourth step with that first sponsor, but my first fourth step had like 11 people on it. So somebody wasn't being honest with themselves. I truly believe they didn't resent anybody when I got to AA, that I was a forgive and forget, bygones be bygones, you know, wear my heart on my sleeve kind of gal, that I was super helpful and self-sacrificing, and I was a martyr. And that turned out not to be the case. So I got an opportunity to start reading the big book with this woman, and I finally was able to see through reading with her and her sharing her experience that I did have that mental obsession, that I did have that physical allergy that they talk about in the big book. You know, I wasn't quite sure about the spiritual malady part, you know, hold your horses there, but I was able to admit to myself that I was powerless over alcohol and that my life had become unmanageable. I remember her asking me if what time I got up in the morning. And I said, ha, 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 I'm a single mom of a 3-year-old. I get up whenever my daughter wakes me up. And she was like, yeah, that's not healthy. You should probably get up earlier than your daughter and be an example for her. I had to be taught how to live. I had no idea what I was doing. And so I did. I started getting up 15 minutes earlier than I thought she normally woke up to read 86 through 88 every morning, because that was what it was instructed to me. It was instructed to read that every morning. Don't do anything. Just read it. It was instructed in me to go to 4, maybe 5 meetings a week, find a home group, service position, all of those things. And so I started doing those things. And I remember calling my sponsor one morning crying. It's like not even 7 a.m. and I'm bawling my face off, and I'm like, why do I have to keep reading these pages every morning on awakening? And she was like, she started laughing, as our sponsors do, and she was like, oh sweetie, she was like, you should know, you've been reading it every day, like the third to last paragraph. We alcoholics are undisciplined, so we let God discipline us in the simple way. I'm just like, okay, you're right, I'll do it, that's fine. But I took suggestions, and it's because I know for a fact it's because at some point, well, September 9th, I feel like in my heart of hearts that my higher power and my dad were just like, you know what, Martha is on the wrong path. We got to get her back on the right road. And I had a divine intervention that day. And because it was my father's birthday, my desire to drink was like this much less than desire to save that as my sobriety date, because I knew it meant something. And I clung to that. Went through the We Agnostics. I didn't know what an agnostic was. I knew what an atheist was. It means they don't believe. But it had to be explained to me what an agnostic was. And I got to learn that I was one of them, that I needed proof. You know, that if my foxhole prayers to God didn't work, then maybe he wasn't out there. And I still find myself sometimes saying, you know, God, if I don't see you working in my life, are you really there? You know, because I was raised with the God of the heavens, the one in the throne with the robe and, you know, not a one personal to me. So being able to read through the book and, again, hearing a sponsor's experience helped me understand that I didn't have to know yet. I just had to be willing to believe, and that was enough. Third step prayer on our knees. Didn't really know what I was doing, but what was really cool is that first sponsor, when I'd read it, she made me like go out on her porch and read it for a while. She's like, go out and read this prayer. And when you are done reading it, it might take 5 minutes, it might take 20, come back inside. And so that's what I did. And I remember at that point going, oh, it's not about me. Like in that third step prayer, like, you know, take away my difficulties so victory over them may bear witness to those I could help. What is this? Okay. Yeah, so I did the third step prayer on my knees. Again, not really understanding what I was turning over. I learned later, everything, every day, all the time. Fourth step, I did it. It took me months. It did. And every time I would call my sponsor, the first thing out of her mouth is, why aren't you writing? Like, damn it, because I want to talk to you about this thing that happened at work, and why aren't you writing? And so I did it, and I did all of it, and I did it just as it says in the book. And then I did a fifth step. You know, a woman in the program volunteered to come over and watch my daughter for me so I could go do this fifth step. I got to do it in one sitting. My sponsor crocheted the whole time and fell asleep, I swear, at least once. And I'm like trying to give backstory. I'm like, don't you understand? This is so important. This is my life. And you know, but she'd heard it. And if she hadn't heard, I remember there was one thing that I, you know, was on there, and she said, yeah, that's pretty messed up. Man, don't do that again. But, you know, it's all, if you're alcoholic, we probably have similar character defects, guys. I didn't know that. I thought I was unique for a long time. You know, 6 and 7 is pretty clear instructions in the book. It's short, but it tells you exactly what to do. And it says, I think it says, like, without haste or immediately or, like, right now, something along those lines. You do 6 and 7 right after the fifth step. And so I was starving, so I drove through a Panera drive-thru, which I didn't even know they had those. So cool. I was, like, very excited. Went through the drive-thru, got my Panera, and pulled into an empty parking lot and did what it said in the book. I read through steps 1 through 5 and made sure that my foundation was strong. And then I read what it said in 6, and then I read that 7-step prayer over and over and over, and I had a sense of peace and comfort come over me. I remember crying, I'm sobbing in this parking lot, and I just said, I don't want to be that girl anymore. And I had a spiritual experience. I swear I had arms physically wrap around me and tell me that I didn't have to be that girl anymore. And I felt it, and I knew it. You know, 8, it says we already have our list. We took it, we made it when we made inventory. And so I made the list, and then I added, you know, and there's some I added. And I remember with 4, I freaked out and balked, and a friend said, well, because I was afraid of 5. And she said, just do it. You're on step 4, right? And 8 was kind of the same because I was really afraid of 9. And so to add names on there that maybe I hadn't had no resentment associated with was hard. But then, you know, it was reminded again, you're on 8. And I got to go through that list with my sponsor. And, you know, there are people on that list that to make amends to them would cause more harm. You know, my baby's father was in a relationship. And so my child is basically a secret child, you know. To make amends to his now wife, who doesn't know anything about my daughter, would cause more harm. And through working the steps and being able to see my part and to be able to know that more will be revealed, I don't have to have the answer to that right now about how my daughter's father is ever going to be in her life. I don't need to know the answer. It's okay. She is loved and well-adjusted and happy. And that's amazing. The amends process was really, really cool. What it taught me is that I got to meet people where they are. And that I really, my expectations of who you should be was really a hang-up of mine. And it really caused a lot of damage. And, you know, I got to make amends to my father and my late husband, who, again, aren't on this earth anymore. I actually now, again, you know, 3 years of sobriety, have found a way to make amends to my sister, you know, just through being able to work these steps. And it's just incredible. Made amends to my little brother, and that one was pretty special. He stopped me and went upstairs and got his guitar, and he's a wonderful musician, and he came downstairs and he said, "I want to play you a song I wrote for you when you lived in Baltimore." And it was, Baltimore was where I owned my business and I was just having a grand old time. And it's a song, he called it "So I Write to You in Baltimore." And it was about his wish for me to find a spiritual solution in my life. So that was pretty special. You know, whether they say 10, 11, and 12 are maintenance, BS. You got to do that to survive every single day. you know, 10, 11, I always got confused about. I'm like, the prayer meditation, but there's like this nightly review in here that's like part of the inventory. And you know what? It doesn't matter. Because 10 has clear-cut directions of what I need to do if I cause harm throughout the day. And the prayer meditation piece, getting quiet with God, you know, somebody told me long ago, you know, praying is talking to God, meditating is listening. I'm really bad at listening. I really am, you know, but it is true that if you sit quiet enough, the answers will come. And that's pretty cool. 12 is amazing. I when I first came into AA, my ego was really, really big. It's still big sometimes. I'm human. It's a human problem, right? But, you know, I was like, I'm going to sponsor the world. There's my first meeting that I went to is a Friday night meeting that draws 250 people on Friday nights. And I was like, I can't wait to speak at that meeting and drop spiritual bombs, and it's going to be amazing. Yeah, I still haven't been asked to speak at that meeting. But 12 has been really cool to be able, you know, I've read the very beginning of this a lot of times. This is really cool. It was pointed out to me that in step 12, we try to carry the message. In the beginning, I really wanted you to get this thing. And if you didn't take these suggestions that I'm giving to you, they're not really suggestions. You need to do them because that's what I did. And, not everybody sticks around. You know, some leave and come back, and some leave and don't come back. But I've read the first couple of chapters of this book a lot out loud to a sponsee while they have their pen and their highlighter. And I tell them to underline or highlight or circle everything that I was told to underline, highlight, or circle. Take a note of this, right? And it's really, really cool. And I learned something new. I read with a sponsee earlier today, and I was like, I'd never even thought of that before. And it was more about alcoholism. And it was just a really cool moment for me. It just kind of hit me, and God speaks through me to my sponsees and speaks through other people. And that's a really beautiful thing to be a part of. Today, I'm unemployed. I'm facing a major back surgery in a couple weeks. And I am not paralyzed by fear. And that's incredible. I get up every morning and get my 6-year-old, she's 6 now, first grade, get her on the bus at 7:10 in the morning and apply for jobs and work with sponsees and see where I can be of service to others. And then I get her off the bus at 2:30, and I'm learning still to this day how to be present with her. Because I don't know why I found that so uncomfortable. She's amazing. You know, her voice sometimes, like when she says mommy a certain way, I start to twitch a little bit, but I'm finding peace and I'm learning to be a mom and be present for my daughter. And I'm a work in progress. And that's pretty cool. I don't have to know the answers. I don't have to know what job's around the corner for me, because there is one. you know? And that's really beautiful. I get the opportunity to show up for my family and be of service. I still try and fix, manage and control my life and others. But I get the opportunity every day to turn my will and my life over to God and say, God, I don't know what's best for me. You do. I think I'll trust you. So I think that's all I have. Thanks.